Chevy Equinox EV is a game changer with an EPA estimated 319 miles of affordable range. Now get 0% APR financing on an Equinox EV. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for details. It'll change the way you think about driving.
Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. Dogs and cats living together. Can it be done? This man knows. His name is Bob Walker. He's an author, a photographer. He's written some best-selling books, The Cat's House and Cats Into Everything, among his books. We'll talk about those books, which I loved at the time, and I'll explain why. And we'll talk about his most recent book. But first, Bob, good morning. Good to talk to you again.
Good morning, Steve. It's been a long time. Hi.
It has been a long time. And you were reminding me, and I really don't remember, of the story that last time, which was more than a decade, if not decades ago. That
25 years ago.
How do you remember when this was and what happened?
Well, because my book that I was at a conference was Cats Into Everything. I did a presentation there at the conference way back in 2020, so that's a memorable time. The book came out in 99, but anyway. So that's when, you know, you met me in the lobby and you looked at my waist and I thought, this is pretty weird. And then you asked me for my belt, which was even more weird because you had forgotten your belt and you were going to give a presentation right then. You didn't want to have your pants fall down. So anyway, I think that I helped keep you your career from that point on.
If it wasn't for Bob Walker, my pants would have fallen down, I guess. I don't even...
In public.
I don't remember that, to be honest, but I take your word
for it. Not remember that.
I know, I don't. I want to tell you why I loved these other books that you did. And friends, if you don't know the name of the book, The Cat's House, you probably know Bob's photography, because you were, I think, the first to actually, many people have done this, but design your house for your cat. So you had walkways and bridges and all these things that the cats could climb everywhere that were specifically for the cats, and also in very bright, vibrant colors that was your house that I think won design awards even. Am I right?
Yes. Yes, we've been called the paw father of the pet environmental enrichment movement, because we kind of went to the extreme and put mouse hole shaped openings through walls and flame shaped holes and had 140 feet of cat path. And it kind of originated because we realized that, you know, the cats love to look down on you, you know, and so that, you know, we put them above our heads. And so while you watch TV, fur would float down.
Well, I love that, because even back then, I was talking about enrichment for dogs and for cats. And I worked at a zoo. And working at a zoo, I saw what the Lincoln Park Zoo did to enrich the lives of the animals at the zoo. And I thought, why aren't we doing that for dogs and cats? Now, today, there's lots of science to demonstrate how this is and why this is beneficial for our pets. But back then there wasn't. My gut told me this was the right thing to do. And there you were coming along demonstrating that, yes, here is a way to enrich the environment. Now, I think even one of the images from your book might be a slide even today in one of my presentations. And while you may go to, I don't want to say an extreme, but to an extent that many others may not go to, what it does is it gives us an example of what it can be. And did you find that once you did this for your cats, that you found a change in behavior in your cats for the better? Because you did enrich, and boy, did you enrich their environment.
Yes, there was a change in the sense that they spent a lot of time overhead after we did it. You know, is that we created a scratching column room divider, and they would race full speed down our long hallway and go up this column and across, and it was a dead end. And so then we realized that they needed an exit from that. And so that's what kind of led to putting the cats overhead. So that's their sanctuary for loud noises like trash trucks and children, you know, and all that sort of thing.
Well, it's a terrific book. It's still available, The Cat's House. But we are here to talk about a lost dog finds cat paradise, tales of love and mischief.
Yes.
Tell that story.
Well, that came about because Francis and I, my partner of 50-plus years, when we came home from a Mexican dinner appropriately, a starving Chihuahua puppy was bouncing up and down at our legs when we arrived home. And so we tried our best to find its rightful owner, but we couldn't. And then, because we had just the day before adopted two feral from a feral mom kittens, and so we didn't really want a dog. But it turns out that we didn't know we needed a dog, and she enriched our lives and became my best friend. So the book is my homage to her and our bonding and the living with the cats and the kittens and growing up together.
So when Sadie, the dog, came into your home, how many cats did you have at that point total?
We only had 10.
So were you concerned about the old adage, dogs, cats, they cannot live together?
Yes, actually no, because Francis had been at a grocery store loading groceries a few years prior, and a Siberian Husky jumped in the van. And Frances at that time was afraid of dogs. And so she came home with this dog in the car. And once again, we tried to find its owner, and we ended up falling in love and adopting the dog. So we had had a prior dog named Sasha in our lives. So we knew they could get together.
So how did you integrate one dog, by the way, who was smaller, I believe, than some of your cats, with all of those cats?
Oh, well, luckily, what we do like with the cats is we bring kittens home and we put them in a carrier cage and we kind of leave it in the middle of the room and we allow the other cats to kind of sniff and smell and say bad things to them. And then we slowly open the doors of it and then release them and then try to play with them. Well, it was kind of the same thing we did about Sadie, where we let everybody, what the heck is this? What did you do to our lives again? Here, you know, and by bringing this dog into the house or whatever it is, you know, and, you know, so anyway, that, you know, you just watch and try to distract them all. So they're kind of integrating and it worked, you know, and then that's what the book shows is that they all got to, you know, love each other and sleep together and, you know, play together and play. You know how dogs go barking and yelling and screaming at each other, and you think they're going to kill each other, but that's what the dog and the kittens would do. And it would, you know, then the next moment they're in a pile together sleeping, you know.
Well, I want to talk more about that communication gap, because dogs speak dog, cats speak cat, and how you how you brokered that as a United Nations translator. A lost dog finds cat paradise. Tales of Love and Mischief. And we'll be back with Bob Walker on WGN. Bob Walker is a photographer and author. His most recent book, A Lost Dog Finds Cat Paradise. But at first, Bob, I read the book, it wasn't necessarily paradise. And part of the problem was you had all these cats, including these two little kittens that spoke cat. And you had one dog coming in who was like, I don't know this dog's history or background or anything, but of course, the dog spoke dog. You didn't know if the dog had previous experience with cats or if that experience, if there was one, was a positive one or not. So how did you deal with these communication gaps that were clear at first?
Well, we didn't know what the heck we were doing to start off with because it was a dog, you know. Even though we'd had a previous dog, this was a puppy, you know, that definitely had opinions about things and would bite. And so we bought some magazines, you know, one of them about Chihuahuas to see what the heck Chihuahuas were like because we didn't choose her. She chose us. And but the old thing is that all of the good book learning and all that doesn't help you when it's the reality situation. We've got two kittens, and we just kept them together and made sure they didn't do anything bad, and nothing bad happened, and they became the best of friends. You know, it wasn't anything real complex, honestly. You know, maybe that job the United Nations is awaiting, you know?
Well, you mentioned Chihuahuas. So Chihuahuas have a certain, shall I say, reputation. Of course, you can only speak for your dog, but
yes.
Tell me how the books may have differed or not from your dog Sadie's personality.
Uh-huh. Well, the when we in the book, we show at towards the end, we show that we've sold our cat's house and we are moving to the Mid-Atlantic and temporarily in a RV park here in San Diego, and because we came back just to get you back here, and when the person we were signing in says that no pit bulls or angry chihuahuas were allowed, you know.
And
so that, and I know you're a pit bull advocate there,
yeah,
as far as good rights and everything. So anyway, well, we had the chihuahua compliment to that, and so ours was perfect, no problem. She only barked, you know, we didn't tell this to that person, but she only barked when people came too close to our RV, you know, to protect us. So she wasn't a vicious dog. She was a protector. So, but anyway, the difference in the books, she was all bark and a lot of bite. In fact, her first name when we got her, because we didn't know our genders very well. In fact, the vet told us that he was not a she. I mean, she was not a he. that we called her Spike initially because she had razor sharp teeth. So anything, you know, you'd play with her, and oh my gosh, you'd get little bloody marks because of that, you know. So you had to be very careful about how you interacted, and same as the cats. In fact, that's one of the chapters about love called Love Bites, where her wound showed because she's a short-haired creature, and the cats are long-haired so that you couldn't see their wounds, but also they have much longer arms than she has, so they can whack and keep her at a distance where she has to get in close. So she loses, you know. So anyway, you know, she survived. We all survived. And we got a book out of it.
Well, and ultimately, first of all, I have another question to ask you before I get to the cats and dogs, getting along great at the end. But, you know, you lived in an RV with your partner. Human partner with
she. What's this? Is she? Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. With Sadie the dog, and with how many cats?
Oh, we only had 8 cats at that time. You
so
know,
you had when eight? That's what I'm getting at. 8 cats, a dog, and 2 people in one RV. How did that go?
Well, oh, very crowded. You know, in fact, we didn't use the kitchen, the oven. Stovetop, because you know there's just no space, and so that's just one of the surface areas that the cats would be going over. So we did all of our cooking outside in a hot plate to make sure that we no hot feet, you know, burned paws, you know, in the RV. But yeah, one of the photos I have in the book shows like 7 cats in the photo and the dog, you know, and a very tight space.
And why would you do this with 8 cats rather, and a dog and 2 people in one RV?
Well, I did research about moving across country, and when I checked out like motels and stuff, several of them had limits, like two animals or 3 animals. I don't remember the number anymore, but it would have taken us having to rent 4 rooms at each different location to be able to, you know, house all of our animals, you know, and that would have been prohibitively expensive to have this, you know, whole wing of a motel with all of your animals and you in them, you know.
Well, I thought you would say, well, the goal is to get a book out of it, which you did.
Well, I photo-hounded her for a long time. And actually, the book is like the first part of a 2-part book, because we lived in Virginia for 8 years. And unfortunately, Sadie died at 10 years of age. So this book is like 3.5 years of the documentation. And that gives us another 6.5 years I documented in Virginia with snow and the travel across country. And so anyway, one more book to come.
But even without that one more book to come, it's clear by the end of this book, the skeptical you and Francis, wound up falling totally head over heels in love with, you had previous history greatly with cats, with a dog.
Yes.
A dog with monster teeth named Sadie. What was it about Sadie that struck you or maybe surprised you the most?
Well, one thing that I liked about Sadie is you come home, you've been gone, you know, either all day or 15 minutes, and she rolls over and barks and offers her belly for you. And, I mean, she shows so much love and expression, and wants to get her belly rubbed. but anyway, you know, I mean, come on, Frances, my wife, wouldn't do that. You know, the cats don't do that, you know. So she gets between us in bed, you know, so, you know, you know, she's a good separator there. And, she cuddles with you. She tells, she just was a wonderful critter, you know.
Yeah, I do know. The name of the book is called A Lost Dog Finds Cat Paradise, Tales of Love and Mischief. And in this book, Bob Walker, the author, proves once and for all they don't need to fight like cats and dogs. And in fact, even survived with his wife after living in an RV with all those cats and one dog to still write another book. Bob, it's great to reconnect with you.
Same here, and I'm glad you got that belt still on you, you know?
Yeah, my pants haven't fallen down yet. Thank you, Bob Walker.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's a pleasure to get back with you here again.
So you're wondering where to go? I'm about to tell you. WGNradio.com to listen to past shows. We podcast everything. So if you missed Dr. Kevin Fitzgerald, you may remember him from Emergency Vets on Animal Planet. We talked about, and I want to have him back on. I mean, his book is fascinating. It's how he got to be where he is today. And the Rolling Stones have something. The Rolling Stones, he was a bouncer for the Rolling Stones. He's also a stand-up comic. And he said he learned a lot about comedy from, and cigar smoking, from George Burns. There have been stories about Chicago Animal Care and Control and the issue they have, which is serious, more animals coming in than they can adopt out. Well, we talked about that weeks ago with Armando Tejeda of Chicago Animal Care and Control. You can hear that conversation as well as one with Simon Tofield, the creator of Simon's Cat, all at WGNradio.com. This is Stacey LeBaron. She is the voice behind the Community Cats podcast and the winner of an award. Congratulations, Stacey. The Every Cat Health Foundation has a communications award every year in which the award is given to a member of the media or someone who communicates to the general public in some way, shape, or form about cats. And you've got it this year. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so excited.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you because I think that trap, neuter, return, and I want to get the word vaccinate in there somewhere because I think they should be, if at all possible, vaccinated for at least rabies. But we can talk about that, but let's back up a little bit. What is the Community Cats Podcast?
So the Community Cats Podcast is a podcast that we released back in 2016. So we have over 600 episodes of the show. And for those of you who aren't familiar with a podcast necessarily, there are, you know, various YouTube and Apple and other places that you can listen to a podcast. You can tune in, and it's like this. It's like a radio show. I get to talk to folks that are turning their passion for cats into action. Comes out once a week, and it's a wonderful opportunity for us to be able to share incredible stories of people who are doing that, turning their passion for cats into action, and having us all believe that we're able to create a better community for cats. So we've been doing this since 2016, which I guess they say consistency in the podcast world is hard to do. So we're very proud of the fact that we are still around and almost not, you know, 9 years here. And it's a show. It's a nice show. It's uplifting. It's happy. We're not all gloom and doom. And we'd love people to tune in.
All right. And we'll
talk more about how people can do that, but we just kind of described that. By the way, this show, this very radio show, and pretty much everything at WGN Radio is podcasted at WGNRadio.com. Our regular listeners, I believe, know that. Now, Community Cats Podcast, what gave you the idea to do this? Have you been an advocate for community cats, which by definition for some was one, they were once called feral cats, so you know what we're talking about. How did the idea come about?
Yeah, so I ran a nonprofit organization in Massachusetts for 16 years. I've been involved in animal welfare since 1994, so that gives you a sense of my age. I started in my 20s and ran this organization for 16 years, and we were founded because of a group of cats, 300 cats living on the Newburyport waterfront, and we did trap, neuter, return. Had 14 feeding stations. And when we do say trap, neuter, return, we do say there were vaccines included. So some do say TNVR.
I'm a TNR. Fan of that. Yeah, yeah.
And it's rabies and distemper vaccines to help protect the overall colony and to serve a public health initiative, which is protecting the community from the spread of rabies from wildlife. And actually, the community cats act as a barrier of spreading disease from the wildlife through to, you know, children or to folks, to people. So it really does have a public health initiative to it. So I ran this organization for quite a few years, and I really kind of felt like we had done a lot of great work. And I had learned from others all around the country about the work that they were doing, and I wanted to be able to share. And when I sort of stepped back from day-to-day operations, my 13-year-old son at the time suggested that I start a podcast. He was recording his music of his electric guitar, and he said, it'd be so easy just to record a show, Ma. You should just do that. And so I just started up this podcast with a colleague of mine, and I really felt that in the cat world. I don't know if you feel this way, but sometimes people feel pretty isolated in this cat space. And so I wanted to ensure that somebody had the opportunity to hear from a passionate cat advocate at any time of the day. If they're out there trapping cats in the middle of the night thinking nobody cares, I wanted them to be able to just turn me on and I can help them feel like they're not all alone.
Well, nobody cares, it's people who do this at some point in time, and I would argue still today to a lesser extent, are denigrated. For saving cats, they're just outdoor cats. Why would you want to do that? Why would you want to? Why don't you just take them in and euthanize them? That was actually, I'm old enough that was actually the thinking at one point. And even today, there are people who say, "Well, those cats cause more harm than good." I'm sure you've heard that. Can you comment on that?
I can. In terms of thinking about the source of these cats. If your ultimate goal is to reduce the number of cats that are outdoors because you feel like nobody's caring for them, nobody is an advocate for them, no one is getting them spayed or neutered, the best thing you can do is have a trap, neuter, return and managed program, as well as providing spay, neuter services to the owned cat community. Also, as I say often, it all starts with Adam and Eve, you know, two cats that are in homes or that for whatever reason end up on the street and they're not spayed or neutered. Thus begins a community cat colony. And so, you know, we need to ensure that we're providing resources and services to cats at all levels within the community in order to be able to reduce the cat overpopulation situation in that particular town. And that is the humane way of reducing and managing our community cat populations. Trapping and removing and euthanizing those cats doesn't stop the repopulation of that area. So if you remove 30 cats from an area where there's a food source, the next year you're going to have another 30 or 35 cats right back in that location. So you really haven't done anything other than just replaced 35 cats for another 35 cats.
Well,
so
actually,
we're approaching it from a different angle.
Yes, and I'm interrupting you only because I want to make a point. You know, I think if I remember right, it's called the vacuum effect. So let's say there are 30. That is right. I remember that right?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. So.
A plus.
Yeah, okay. So let's say there are 30 cats in a cat colony, a group of cats or a clouder. There are 30 cats there. Let's just say that number. And then if 10 are taken away and euthanized, or even 20 are taken away and euthanized, what will happen is you will end up with 40 to 50 to 55 cats, and the number will actually grow. Can you explain how that happens?
Yeah, well, so it goes back to depending on what the area provides. But yeah, Mother Nature, near the end of our time in Newburyport, where we had a few female cats that we still hadn't been able to trap, Mother Nature does wonderful things. We had cats having 9 kitten litters, 11 kitten litters. So Mother Nature tries to rebuild the population as long as there's the food source there to support them. And then also the vacuum effect is where cats from other areas that are limited on resources and say that population is overwhelmed, cats will move into the territory and add more numbers to that group. And then there'll be, you know, cats that are left behind just by the general human population.
Yep. She is the head cat, the founder of Community Cats Podcast, Stacy LeBaron. Much more to talk about regarding community cats. I mean, how do we lower the numbers? Does TNR, or trap, neuter, return with vaccinate in there somewhere, really work? We'll answer those questions and more when we come back on WGN. The award-winning Community Cats Podcast, the Every Cat Health Foundation, said, "Hey, Stacy, you, the founder of this podcast, earn an award for communications. Are you aware of the nonprofit Every Cat Health Foundation and what this organization does?" And by the way, many of the studies that have come out regarding community cats were once funded by this organization.
Yeah, I mean, the Every Cat Health Foundation has been an incredible supporter with regards to providing a space for research for cats. And you know this much more than I do, but I recently co-authored a paper with regards to free-roaming cat population and how to reduce it. It's called The Cat Report at the United Spay Alliance's website. But the Every Cat Health Foundation has been really one of the only places with cat-centric research going on over the years, and I'm sure you can share more on that, but it's an incredible organization, and I'm very appreciative of the acknowledgement of the work that we do, which is also education-focused. We have certification programs, so if people want to be TNR certified, they can actually get a certification, take a test. And we try and elevate the training and education for folks that are really out there advocating for cats on a day-to-day basis.
So there was an entire report that was written, and I wish I had brought in the number. I'm not very good at remembering numbers, so I apologize, Stacy. But the number of billions of birds that community cats kill, songbirds, according to this report, and I looked it up. And we don't even have that many songbirds in the entire country. So that number was clearly exaggerated. But nevertheless, there are many people who feel that community cats should not be there. How do you reply to that?
Oh, I think we live in a world where it's a balancing act for a whole range of different species out there. I live in Vermont. So we see bears, we have, you know, deer, we have moose, we have all kinds of different wildlife, and finding that perfect balance with regards to wildlife and then the cats that are out there in a free-roaming environment. So it's a fine line and a balance. I do think that when you are approaching a situation and you want to do trap, neuter, return, you should be respectful of the environment that you're in. So if you are trying to do trap, neuter, return next to a piping plover colony, your response to that group of cats might be different than if you're doing trap, neuter, return in someone's barn that, you know, has a nice tack room. So it's really important to understand the environment that your cats are in and develop a plan that works not only just for the cats, but for the community at large. So, you know, going back to the topic on birds, I would say, you know, the bird organizations and bird lovers should be as supportive of the spay-neuter efforts out there for, you know, all animal welfare organizations that are doing low-cost, high-quality spay-neuter, because ultimately, at the end of the day, it's going to reduce the outdoor cat population. The more cats that we have that are sterilized, the better off we're going to be. You know, areas where income levels are lower, the number of outdoor cats are going to be higher. As your income goes down, the number of cats you have go up. So those are just some things to think about. So if there's an area with birds that is in a low-income community, that's where you need to put your spay and neuter dollars for cats.
I agree with everything you're saying. And the other thing that just happens to be true, it's a fact, that air pollution, light pollution, and changes in the environment impact birds, songbirds in particular, far more than cats ever will. What's more, that cats do us a favor on occasion, depending on where they're located, because most cats and cats, to my knowledge, don't fly. It doesn't mean cats never catch birds, because they do. But what they really catch in most places, and studies, in fact, one, in fact, funded by the Every Cat Health Foundation from several years back, determined that most cats, outdoor cats, in most places eat rodents. And that shouldn't be, that's not a surprise, but now there's data to demonstrate that's true. In fact, I believe it's Georgia, where a couple of outdoor cat colonies, they ate, if I'm correct that it is Georgia, they ate lizards more than any other source of food. So they eat what they can get, and birds are not always easy to get.
Right. And there are several studies that have happened where, you know, they have found deceased community cats, and so they go and they try and find out, like, what have they been eating, and especially around the questions around rodenticide. It's funny, as a cat person, I get a lot of questions about rats and controlling rat population, and I know that's an evolving topic for sure.
Well, in Chicago, we were the first city. Los Angeles says they were the first, but I believe we were the first to have a working cat program where it was Treehouse Humane Society worked with different public officials in Chicago where they had a difficult time, or buildings, specific buildings in Chicago that could not control the rat issue, and brought in a couple of cats, and suddenly the rats do seem to find new real estate, Stacey.
Yeah, it's Chicago is one of those, you know, model areas where there have been a lot of advocates around working cat programs, so much so, too, that we're trying to develop a working cat program certification process so people are aware of it's not just moving cats and letting them go. There's an adaption process, a relocation, an acclimation process that cats have to go through as they get placed in their new job location. But yeah, Chicago has been a leader in that area for sure.
New job location. I love that. And I love the work. I love the work you're doing. It is important. Listen, we've had community cats or feral cats going back for how many generations? You know, I mean, hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of years. I mean, they've been there. We do want to control their numbers, as you describe. We do want to be sensitive to other animals in the environment and public health. Absolutely true. And greatly, it's a matter of there's so much misinformation out there, and it's a matter of understanding, and in some cases, understanding the benefits that these cats bring us. And that is what you do with the Community Cats podcast. Once again, how can people find you?
Folks can check us out on our website, which is www.communitycatspodcast.com. And yeah, just, you know, thank you again for this great honor. And we also just make it, I believe the tombs in Egypt, the pyramids in Egypt had working cats. So I think that's where our first notation of working cats exists.
All right. I won't argue with that. That does come before Chicago's cat shelter, which is a wonderful cat shelter, Treehouse Humane Society. They've been around a long time. they haven't been around quite that long. Stacey LeBaron, give me that website one more time.
It's communitycatspodcast.com.
Easy enough. Congratulations again, Stacey, and thank you for all the good work that you have been doing and are continuing to do. Thank you. I want to talk a little bit about dogs who pull and people who feel they need a choke collar, those chain link collars, or a prong collar, or otherwise known as a pinch collar for these dogs. No. A harness is fine. And here's, dogs have an opposition reflex. All dogs do. If it's a dog, it's got it. So if you're pulling one way, if you're pulling back on the leash, the dog is going to pull forward. The dog can't help but do that. It's an automatic response that has to do with the dog's direct pathway to its nervous system. So instead, to teach a dog not to pull is to teach a dog not to pull, to walk with the dog at the dog's side. A dog trainer can show you how to do that, but you're far better off using a harness than a device that could create, often does, create pain, but what's more, is pulling one way, so of course the dog's going to pull the other way. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.